Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and I'm talking with Surinda Dara, Entomology and Biologicals Advisor with the UC Cooperative Extension. Dara will be a featured speaker at the upcoming Crop Consultant Conference, and today we get a preview of his presentation. Now, Surinda, I know your name because I know that you have spoken at several things, including things put on by JCS Marketing, and I know that Taylor Chalstrom has also interviewed you a few times, but tell us, what will you be speaking on at the Crop Consultant Conference?
I'm going to talk about how we can use biostimulants as a part of integrated pest management program. Usually for integrated pest management, we talk about suppressing pests, more about curative action and some preventive actions. So this one is entirely different, looking at agronomic practice like, you know, the biostimulants are more or less like nutritional supplements. So how do we use them as a part of IPM program is a kind of like a new area. So I'm going to talk about that.
So I was going to ask you, and you just answered it a little bit, but how new is this exactly? Is it are it just a few people trying this out? Is it something that's been researched and is now becoming used?
That's a good question. Biostimulant use has been around for a long time. But they were used, like there is a lot of information, scientific information about various categories of biostimulants and what they can do to improve crop health and how they contribute to increasing yields and so on. But they haven't been used as much until, recently. They haven't come into mainstream agriculture until recently. So people are using them now. Again, as soil amendments or just, stimulants or nutritional supplements and so on. But my the talk is going to be how you use indirectly for pest and disease management. So there have been studies showing the impact of these biostimulants on crop health and, directly or indirectly how they impact pests and diseases. But the focus has always been using them more as an agronomic input rather than as a pest management option. So I'm going to talk about that aspect. It is not to spray them as pesticides, but how you use them to increase crop health and how that contributes to integrated pest management.
This sounds incredibly interesting because it's a way to manage, as you said, pests and diseases in crops that is different from the ways that they've been managed on the wide scale. So as you're seeing more people start to use this, are you getting more people coming, seeking information about it?
Yes, there has been a tremendous demand, especially from ag input industry, asking me to do studies, and also growers asking about, what does this product do, or what does this kind of a microorganism do, and how can we use? So there has been an increase in awareness about them, and there have also been a lot of products in the market. So it is very important for us, the researchers, to authenticate and develop, strategies for using them effectively.
All right. And they can get some of those answers when you speak at the Crop Consultant Conference coming up in September, right?
That is right.
All right. Thank you, Surinda. The Crop Consultant Conference is September 16th and 17th in Visalia. You can register online by following the link at myaglife.com. Our news brief is coming up next. We will be right back.
The Crop Consultant Conference returns live in person on September 16th and 17th in Visalia, California. Co-hosted by Progressive Crop Consultant Magazine and the Western Region Certified Crop Advisors Association, this must-attend conference features 2 days of educational seminars, a live trade show, and honorariums and scholarships given by Western CCA, including the CCA of the Year Award. Hear the top experts in their field speak on pest management, artificial intelligence and new technologies, as well as the latest on soil health, nitrogen, and irrigation management. DPR and CCA credits will be available over the 2 days. For more information on credits, topics, and registration, visit progressivecrop.com/conference. Agromiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Root Pack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Root Pack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Here's your news for today. This from the California Farm Bureau. Wild temperature swings last fall are believed to be the cause of widespread freeze damage in California's walnut groves. In early November, temperatures dropped from 80 degrees to below freezing in several areas. Freeze damage observed this spring is most severe in Butte, Glynn, and Tehama counties, and is also reported in Lake, San Joaquin, Stanislaus, Yolo, and Yuba counties. Before the freeze, walnut production had been steadily increasing. China and the U.S. are shipping goods back and forth at the quickest pace in years. Bloomberg says that's making it look as if the tariff war and COVID-19 never interrupted the world's largest bilateral trade relationship. Bilateral trade in goods is an area of stability in a relationship that otherwise continues to struggle. In February of 2020, monthly two-way trade dropped to $19 billion amid shutdowns. However, official Chinese data says the trade numbers rebounded over the past year to set new records. Ethanol output during the week ending July 16th dropped to the lowest level in 5 weeks, while inventories climbed higher. The Energy Information Administration says production of the biofuel dropped to an average of 1.028 million barrels per day. That's down from 1.041 million barrels per day on average the previous week and the lowest production level since the week ending June 11th. In the Midwest, which produces the most ethanol of any region in the country, output averaged 980,000 barrels a day, also a five-week low. A coalition of Western farmers, ranchers, water providers, and farm communities is urging the U.S. Senate to pass legislation to upgrade the aging water infrastructure. The California Farm Bureau joined with more than 200 organizations in seeking more than $14 billion in water storage and conveyance projects and related construction as part of President Biden's Jobs and Economic Recovery Plan. The beneficiaries of agricultural innovations are in many cases consumers, whether it's new food products, clothing from natural fibers, or biofuels for transportation. Yet there are ag-based innovations and technologies some consumers may not realize are also playing a key role in their daily lives. Rod Bain looks at some examples of innovation in agriculture as a part of this ongoing series in Agriculture USA.
Innovation has always been an integral part of agriculture. Yet in just a few short years, there have been significant advancements that are practical and available, especially to consumers. Some that perhaps are obvious.
Living in Wisconsin, and you see the amount of varieties of cheese that are being produced, probably over 600 varieties of cheese.
And some that perhaps are not so much.
If you had a surgical procedure that the sutures that decompose within your body, those are corn-based.
And the track towards innovations from research labs and test fields to the consumer is expected to accelerate in coming years, offering great potential when it comes to the diversity of products and uses you and I have or will have available. I'm Rod Bain. And coming up, the latest in an ongoing series on examples of innovation in agriculture in this edition of Agriculture USA. There are constantly new products found at the local supermarkets and retail centers in the food, fuel, and fiber space. That is due to continuing innovation and technology in agricultural research. For example, if you like apples, you have probably noticed the expansion of available varieties, from the traditional red and golden delicious to newer offerings such as Cosmic Crisp, all developed through crossbreeding and ag tech. As Jim Baer of the U.S. Apple Association explains.
That's one of the exciting and frankly fun parts about this business is that there are so many varieties and each with a different taste profile and consumers all have a favorite.
The dairy industry has also benefited from innovation regarding new types of products enjoyed by consumers. Paul Siaminski of Dairy Management Incorporated says for dairy, it goes beyond flavors, but new ways to use products that meet consumer needs.
Around 2000, you started to see more investment in snacking. where it's the sticks, the cubes, right on the go, following the consumer's lives and their behavior. Over the last decade, you started seeing reinvestment in the fluid milk side of the equation, where high protein, low sugar, again, following the consumer needs. You make your money off the consumer.
Many of us, however, may not understand just how many ag-based products are out there that play a role in our everyday lives, beyond what we consume as food and nutrition. The corn industry has for years developed non-food products such as ethanol. But beyond that, examples include decomposing sutures used in surgical procedures. Another example offered by John Fody of the Corn Refiners Association of a product soon to reach the marketplace.
This bio-based drop-in recyclable corn-based plastic has major functional advantages because the product, the packaging would weigh less and would have less gas permeability. So it would improve shelf life and be suitable for products like beer, where gas permeability is especially sensitive.
Growth of industrial hemp and CBD production in recent years has been matched in pace similarly by innovation. Mike Newland of the Propane Education Research Council talks about how his industry has become involved in
CBD oil extraction. The processes vary a little bit depending on the equipment you're using, but there are some folks using an industrial grade propane as a solvent to extract CBD oils.
Innovations are increasing the safety of agricultural products. As an example, USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service and counterparts globally are detecting pathogens and other phytosanitary issues on seeds via molecular-based testing techniques. APHIS Plant Protection and Quarantine Deputy Director Osama El-Lisi says what is known so far about these technologies include:
these technologies can be the most sensitive methods we have of detecting certain plant pathogens. They can also remarkably be specific.
Innovations and technologies take years, even decades, to develop. Yet when available, can not only be consumer successes, but save lives as well. Such innovation is recognized annually through the awarding of the World Food Prize Laureate. The 2021 Laureate, Shakuntala Haraksing Tilsted, developed fish-based products to address issues of malnutrition, particularly of women and children.
These small fish species had very high levels of multiple essential micronutrients. These species could offer life-changing benefits to cognitive development and growth in children and also to their mothers.
Future editions of our series on innovation in agriculture will cover what advances might be available for producers and consumers in the coming years. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's our news for today. When we come back, we look back on a couple of our top segments from this week. We'll be right back.
The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Hi, welcome to My Ag Life. Today, we're talking with Tim Birmingham, Director of Quality Assurance and Industry Services at Almond Board of California, and Guangwei Huang, Associate Director of Food Research and Technology, about almond stockpile management. Welcome, Tim and Guangwei.
Yeah, thanks, Taylor. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for both being here with me today. Tim, I'd like to ask the first question to you. Larger almond harvests mean many huller sheller facilities will need to build stockpiles until nuts can be processed. What do processors need to do to properly manage their stockpiles?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would like to say that stockpiling has been a part of the industry for many, many years. So it's not something that we're just tackling right now as the crop size keeps increasing. It's something that the industry has had to deal with over the years because we don't have all of the instantaneous capacity to haul and shell the almonds as they're coming in. It's a very condensed harvest window and relatively large crop and keeps getting larger. So therefore, you have to create these stockpiles so that you can work your way through these stockpiles over a period of time. So that necessitates the need for these stockpiles. And it's something the industry is quite used to. However, there's some things that definitely you need to be doing as a hauler, sheller, or a grower to make sure that you're properly maintaining the quality of those almonds that are put into the stockpile. And really, I think the main thing, and Guangwei will talk more about this as well, is moisture. You have to control the moisture of the almonds that are going into these stockpiles. If you don't control the moisture, you can have a lot of problems that develop. You can have concealed damage, which results in an interior brown spot of the almond once it's processed. And that creates challenges for the end user because it doesn't necessarily manifest itself until it's been subjected to a heat type process. You can have other issues such as mold growth. And we know that certain molds such as Aspergillus can produce aflatoxin, and that's a big concern for the industry. Particularly when you look at where our product is going, we ship a lot of product to the European market. The European market has tighter tolerances for aflatoxin than what we have here in the US. If we're not able to adequately control the levels of aflatoxin in our product, that's a problem. We'll see more rejections in the EU, and that's very costly. So we want to do everything that we can here on our end really to maintain that quality, to make sure that the almonds in the stockpiles are handled properly and make sure that we're monitoring the moisture. So some things that really I think both the growers and the processors need to be in lockstep with is that moisture coming in out of the field. And so really as a guideline, what we like to say is that the kernel moisture should be less than 6%, the hull moisture less than 12%, or that total fruit, the in-hull, in-kernel, in-shell moisture at less than 9%. If you look at those as benchmarks and you don't put almonds into stockpiles that are at higher levels than those values, then you should be okay. So you really want to control that moisture, coming in. And like I said, it needs to be, communication between the grower and the hauler or sheller. It need to be in lockstep on making sure that moisture is met. Some other things that the haulers need to be aware of, they need to build these stockpiles and they need to build them in a manner that's going to minimize additional problems that could occur once they're in the stockpiles. So some things that we like to advise when you choose the location for your stockpiles, look to see if you can elevate those stockpiles or at least get them on a slightly sloped surface so that you can avoid any moisture that's pooling in the stockpile. You want to drain away any excess moisture that may accumulate. You're going to cover these stockpiles. So when you cover them, you want to you want to do some things that are going to minimize the formation of moisture or pockets of moisture in those stockpiles. So you want to look at flat tops, long stockpiles that are orientated from north to south. That's going to minimize moisture buildup underneath the tarps. You want to look at white on black tarps if possible. That's going to help minimize temperature fluctuation in the stockpile. Temperature fluctuation can cause moisture to develop up on the underside of the tarps and create, pockets of moisture. So that's something that you want to do if possible. I think, you know, once the almonds are in the stockpile, one of the main things is really, you know, understanding what's happening as far as a humidity standpoint or a moisture standpoint in that stockpile. And so that's going to dictate, you know, really how you manage that stockpile. If you're monitoring the moisture in that stockpile, you're looking at the relative humidity, then you can make some decisions as to whether or not you need to vent that stockpile on a periodic basis. And if the humidity in that stockpile is, you know, around 65% or less, I think generally you're okay. If you start to climb above that value, you really need to be looking at management strategies to vent that stockpile on a regular basis to prevent, you know, moisture from building up. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. I think Wang Wei can add some more context around the importance of making sure that we're managing moisture in these stockpiles.
Yeah, definitely, Guang Wei. Obviously, responsibility for proper stockpile management not only falls on the processor, but also falls on the grower here. What measures do you think growers should take during harvest to ensure that a quality crop is delivered for stockpiling?
So, Taylor, you are right. Definitely, this is the responsibility should not only on the hauler-shallers, the other growers can play a huge role in ensuring the quality crop delivered for stockpiling. Many, you know, on the moisture, they really need to deliver properly dry fuel run to the hauler shaller. If they deliver wet product or marginal product to the hauler shaller, it's gonna cause a big headache for hauler shaller. Actually, sometimes the hauler shaller will not able to handle those high moisture fuel runs. So it's really, you know, there's a couple of things that growers can do. Definitely, they should not rush to shake the tree. Monitor the tree, the lot maturity closely. Only shake the tree at the proper time to allow most drying occur when not on still on the trees. That's a much cleaner, a shorter drying. And then, you know, you shake it too early. The product, high moisture product drop on the ground, you take a longer time to dry on the ground. Also, before they shake the tree, they really need to prepare for the harvest. They need to sanitize the orchard, level the orchard, get rid of the debris from the orchard ground so that they have cleaner product. When after they shake the tree, after a few days drying, because the lots fall in the windrow, or fair in the tree rows, they dry unevenly. There is a couple of percentage point difference between the tree row and the windrow. So really after a few days, a couple of days drying on the ground, the grower are encouraged to windrow and they use a conditioner to remove those debris and leaves, allowing more even drying so that can have a better drying. So before, they need to closely monitor the moisture level by their some quick device or simple device or by their experience. They need to test the kernel moisture by their experience or use the equipment from different parts of orchard, because sometimes there's uneven dry in a different zone of orchard. So they have to make sure the most of the moisture from most of the zone areas reach the moisture to the safe moisture level. As a team mentioned, ideally it should be less than 6% in the kernel moisture, less than 12% in whole moisture, or less than 9% in whole lot moisture. However they measure it, they should use either of those should work. So make sure most of the spots that lots from most areas fall in the safe moisture level before they decide to pick up. When they pick up, if the moisture is still in the marginal, they need to try to pick up most lots at the maybe afternoon time. So that allowing that sunlight come out to chase some moisture, the morning moisture or light moisture away, so that they have a deliver drier product to deliver to the orchards. So the real key is really managing moisture level, deliver properly dry product to the hauler shaller. So it can avoid so much issue you're gonna encounter at the hauler shaller side.
You mentioned that there are some ways that these growers can detect kernel moisture, test kernel moisture. Can you go in a little bit about what some of the ways are that they can test their kernel moisture?
There is equipment, like a simple moisture meter based on humidity. Actually, the one company, one Australian company developed the equipment, the moisture meter, that distributed through the floral industry. So they can measure the kernel moisture, they can measure the hole moisture, a portable unit. They can carry with them, just grinding the hole and shell in a simple device. They can measure the read the moisture in a few minutes. So they can measure those. And then most of growers are actually very experienced. When they bite into the kernel, they know what the moisture level can look like. So it's actually empirical experience can help too. So the key is they have to spot check in many spots, make sure the representative of testing being done throughout the whole orchard, because they're quite often, you know, there is uneven drying in a different part of the orchard.
Exposure to some of that excess moisture in the orchard can also be problematic for aflatoxin contamination and concealed damage, which in turn affect food safety and quality of these almonds. Guangwei, how can drying be expedited at the grower processor level in order to prevent some of those issues from occurring?
Yeah, Tanner, as you said, excessive high moisture exposure will cause a couple of concerns. One concern is aflatoxin contamination. And the other concern is related to quality, concern damage formation. So those is also related to the high heat exposure, because the higher moisture in stockpile, they can generate the heat. So create a perfect condition for mold growth, for the condition to form aflatoxin. So the key is really managing moisture as of the lot or field run, as I mentioned by team. You know, this is very critical. The moisture management is the key. So as we, from our study research, we understand at the moisture, kernel moisture less than 6%. So it should have a relatively non-shelf stability, but between 6 to 8%, that's a marginal. So sometimes there's, some enzymatic activity or biological activity in the kernel can happen. This can cause quality deterioration. At the moisture greater than 8% for the prolonged period, the concealed damage can form. So that causes issue. Some mold can grow, can populate, and produce aflatoxin at the high temperature, high heat condition. So this is there's a different levels. So that's why we advise grower to deliver product when the moisture less than 6%. But if there's a marginal issue, you know, like between 6 and 8% is marginal. So hauler shaller had to pay attention to those the truckloads or fuel runs. They had to run quickly as possible, or maybe, you know, through the stockpile management, use the proper tarps, or maybe use the open and daytime cover and evening time, so that they have still have some continued drying going on in the stockpile. So especially when they get to the wet harvest condition, when where problem happens, they really need a good coordination between grower and hauler. The growers worry about the rainfall coming. They want to pick up, the fuel run too quickly. They don't want to get wet from rainfall. But that at the same time, if it's not properly dry, it causes trouble. But also so that they have to really watch out that, weather forecast. Make sure they don't shake the trees when the rainfall is coming. So really, but if you have that on the ground, get encounter rainfall, but they don't try to pick up quickly. Trying to run, dry on the open ground is faster than the stockpile. So that maybe trying to do, when when the ground is dried up, they get in to do a maybe turn. That's if they already windrow, they can turn out windrow. If not, then maybe use a conditioner to get the debris and dry faster. So those actually can help to reduce the potential damage from rainfall. That's critical. So when you know, somehow when grower delivers some high moisture loads of fuel run to the processor side, so during this rainfall event, so if possible, hauler shaller should they use mechanical drying to reduce the moisture to a safe level as quickly as possible. If not, no drying equipment available, hauler shaller may try to dry on open ground with a fan or ventilation, not gonna help to dry in faster to reduce the moisture. So do not stockpile when the lots are still of high moisture, at greater than 8%, lose an internal moisture. And the whole still soaking wet or green, especially get to the rainfall. So that's very critical. We encourage grower dry their rainfall wet not on the ground. Deliver properly dry product to hauler shaller. When hauler shaller receive high moisture node, they had to try to dry as quickly as possible.
Talking with Tim Birmingham, Director of Quality Assurance and Industry Services at Almond Board of California, and Guangwei Huang, Associate Director of Food Research and Technology, about almond stockpile management. Tim, my next question here is for you. What does the ideal site look like for creating a stockpile?
Yeah, so when you're choosing where to put your stockpiles, you really want to look for an area where you can have a raised or a sloped bottom. That's going to help to drain any moisture away from the stockpile, and that's going to help with any mold growth. And then the shape and the positioning of the stockpiles can also be used to help control the moisture and the mold growth. As we mentioned earlier, you should have an even, flat top. It's going to help to avoid any hot pockets of condensation that can develop. And it's also going to help to maintain the moisture in the stockpile itself. The orientation of the stockpile, you really want to make sure that goes from north to south axis. That's going to also help to prevent mold, which usually will be worse on the north end of a pile if the long side is orientated on an east to west axis. So that's why we always like to see the stockpiles in north to south orientation.
With some of these larger harvests, Tim, I know that some growers also have the option of making their own stockpiles in their orchards as well. Do those stockpiles that the growers are creating look any different from the ones that the processors are creating, or are they kind of advised to follow the same guidelines that the processors are for those stockpiles?
Yeah, the same stockpiles that you would see at a hauler shaller facility. The guidelines are the same if growers were to stockpile as well. We would advise that they, try to identify a location that is probably going to be away from the orchard on a flat, raised surface or slightly sloped surface for draining that moisture. And then all the same principles are going to apply. They want to orientate those north to south. They want to make sure that they're flat on top. And ideally, they'll put a white on black tarp and be monitoring the moisture levels within those stockpiles. But I think the preferred route would really be to get those almonds to the hauler sheller. Those folks are really well-versed in how to manage the stockpiles. So I think that is probably the preferred route.
All right. We have time for one more question here. Guangwei, do you have any other tips for processors or growers looking forward to the upcoming harvest for proper stockpile management?
As you mentioned, we have, coming up a bigger crop. Definitely, we're going to expect the more stockpile, longer stockpiling. So there is huge coordination between growers and haulers is essential to ensure the properly dry fuel run to be delivered to stockpiling. The grower really should closely monitor moisture to decide the pickup time. Trying to pick up the fuel run during afternoon, if the moisture level are marginal, the hauler shaller should measure moisture from each truckload or fuel run, then mix the truckload from different zone of the orchard, because that, because as I explained, there is some uneven drying in the orchard floor. So when they come in, want to mix those in the evening proper light, and mix together probably better, and I have allowing some homogenized level in a zone. So if a hollow shallow receives some marginal the moisture level load, they can stockpile make a smaller stockpile, and then closely monitor the stockpile. You know, managing through the, you know, use a tarps, a cover, uncover, you know, uncover during daytime, cover and allowing drying happen in daytime, and then cover in the evening time, preventing moisture pickup during during evening time. So those are very critical. And that sometimes can happen if we encounter some wet harvest, but don't get panicked. Growers really take calm to do everything they can on the orchard floor, make sure properly dry before they deliver to the hollow shallow site. I think that's really critical for, you know, hollow shallow had to closely work together. You know, Tim, you have other suggestions. I think it is definitely our grower knows, you know, how to handle the stuff. It's just only run into some extreme wet harvest condition, but don't be panicked. You know, and then work together, coordinate with the hollow shallow, you know, schedule right pickup time. Now maybe Tim, you can offer some your insight suggestions.
Yeah, you know, I think as we hit on the key is really controlling that moisture. And so from a grower standpoint, you know, you don't want to harvest when it looks like rain is in the forecast. If those nuts are already on the orchard floor and it gets rain, you want to make sure that you give them ample time to dry. And before the nuts are put into the stockpile, you ideally want to have those nuts with the kernel moisture of less than 6%. Those are the main things. And then, you know, once they're in the stockpile, making sure you're maintaining the and monitoring the stockpile properly.
One last thing here. I just kind of want to clarify something that you mentioned there, Guangwei, a bit ago about kind of that creating that homogenized drying scenario. So you're saying that some nuts from different parts of the orchard will have higher moisture content than others. And so you don't want to pair just those higher moisture content nuts together. You kind of want to mix them all together to kind of speed up that drying process. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, that's you're right. That's basically what I'm trying to say. Maybe I didn't say clearly. It's really because that, you know, there is uneven drying from orchard ground. You know, when hollow shallow receive this truckload, when they measure moisture, they know what the moisture in each lot, each truckload. So they can maybe, you know, when they do make a stockpile, they can mix those high slightly higher moisture and the dry product with dry product load. That way, make it more even, because in the during stockpiling, especially under the tarp coverage, you know, this is a really equilibrate. You know, they can, you know, basically there's a slightly higher moisture can be absorbed by the drier product. So make it more even moisture level for the whole product. This is good practice. I think, you know, some of those experienced hollow shallow is doing this. I think I encourage other hollow follow those two. Other device, maybe hollow shallow can look into, especially now with the new tool available, those are portable, or, you know, the, you know, Wi-Fi access sensors. So hollow shallow can explore to use some of those humidity sensor or temperature sensor placed in the different part of a stockpile. They can read from their app to look at, you know, how humidity change. If, you know, they don't even have to open the tarps. Like, you know, like Tim mentioned, it's critical point. They have to continue to monitor the change of humidity, because humidity closely relate to moisture level. So if they have some portable or Wi-Fi accessible the sensor, they can read the you know, the humidity or temperature from the stockpile, different spark stockpile. They know if it's a, you know, they need to take some action. If they need to open the tarp to allowing, you know, some condensation evaporate, or maybe, you know, it's never marginal, you want to run this pile you know, process this part sooner than the other part. This is some device and some new tools Holler Scholler can explore to help them wisely manage in the stockpiles. Management is, it take a time. They just need to closely monitor change, the humidity change in the stockpile. It's not always you receive the lot, the truckload from ultra ground, and then you know, stockpile left there alone for several months. That's, I don't think that's good practice. So there's definitely some new tool can help the Holler Scholler to reduce some burden in there for the close monitoring.
Okay. Well, Tim and Guang Wei, really critical information coming from you both today about almond stockpile management, especially looking ahead to this upcoming harvest, which is supposed to be big. So thank you for both coming on today and providing some clarification on that stockpile management.
Thank you. Thank you. Great talk to you.
Yeah, thank you, Taylor.
Yeah, great to have you both on. This is Taylor with My Ag Life.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Joining me on the phone is Richard Waycott, the president and CEO of the Almond Board of California.
All right, Richard, thank you again for taking my call today. I wanted to talk about the report that came out, the California Almond Objective Measurement Report, and it shows a slight decrease from last year's number and from what was expected, the forecast, I guess, for this year's. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that. We had such a big year, it seems, last year. Are these numbers for this year more normal?
Well, if you look back a couple of years, really starting in 2018, between 2018 and 2020, so two crop years, California almond production grew by 37%, which is just unprecedented. It was about 840 million pounds of additional volume in those 2 years that was created. And so we've come off of these two mega sort of bumper crop years. And we saw some extraordinary yields per acre that contributed to the bumper crops. And you know, the conventional wisdom was that typically, you know, orchards get a little tired after producing that much and sort of tend to, you know, take a year off or whatever, decline for a little bit, and then maybe they resume something close to those yields. But so that was expected. And then I think the effect of the drought and deficit irrigation that is going on in certain parts of the state contributed to the lower number as well. So we had, you know, a lot of industry folks sort of thinking in that 2.8 to 2.9 range, maybe a little higher. The subjective estimate, which came out in May, was at 3.2 billion. So this was a reduction of 400 million pounds in terms of the difference between the two estimates that are produced by the National Agricultural Statistics Service, which is part of USDA. So anyway, I think, you know, for the reasons I mentioned, a slightly smaller crop this year seems reasonable.
And then, of course, we need to talk about the drought, as you brought it up as well. You know, we keep asking our growers to grow as much or more with less water or no water in some cases. And how much of an effect will that continue to have?
Well, my experience, and I think most in the industry, dates back to the last drought, which was in the mid-2010s, so 2013, 14, 15, those years. And what we saw was that, you know, some growers that are in the most precarious places in terms of groundwater supply or poor groundwater quality were the ones that were really affected the most. some of those, you know, pushed out their orchards at that time. I think some growers now are looking out at the future and maybe taking out orchards sooner than they would have, just because, you know, by replanting a new orchard, you can reduce your water consumption during the early years, and maybe they're making that decision. And then others will do what they did last time, which is use best practice in terms of deficit irrigation and try and get through the summer the best way they can, produce whatever crop they can the summer. And then, you know, we always, in farming, you've got your fingers crossed that we're going to have a decent precipitation year this fall and this winter. So so those are sort of, I think, what's going on in terms of a grower decision-making right now.
And can we talk a little bit about demand? It seems like demand is still very strong for California almonds.
Yes. Yeah, so we, I think I'd like to acknowledge and compliment our industry. As I mentioned, we've grown 37% in 2 years, which is just incredible, especially coming off of a large volume base to begin with. And we had to harvest that and process it and ship it and sell it and ship it. And, you know, almond pricing has been lower this past year due to, you know, such large supply that's out there, but also due to the uncertainties that COVID presented, that some of the foreign markets, you know, the experiences they were going through in terms of lockdowns, and then the West Coast port situation, which you've probably heard about, which has been going through a lot of congestion and difficulty in getting containers and so on. And, you know, with all that, our industry's shipped you know, globally, we're up over 20% this year versus last year, and exports are up 30% over last year. So despite everything, you know, we've been able to sell this and ship most of it. Probably would have had higher numbers if we hadn't had the port problems. But it's just a testament, I think, to the value that the global consumer sees in almonds and the consumer products companies that produce, you know, the myriad products that are produced with almonds as an ingredient. And when there's a larger supply, granted there's a price advantage at the same time, we're able to place this product globally, and the market's there for it and the consumers are there for it. So you know, all around, you know, not a great economic year for the industry, but certainly we've been very successful in marketing the product.
All right. And then overall, as people are hearing, you know, snippets about the report, what do you want them to know overall about the report?
Well, I think that they should look at it in terms of how we're finishing up this current crop year, which ends at the end of this month. Even though our shipments have been record every month this year, except for January, overall inventory that we're going to end up at the end of this month, which we call the carry-in, so what inventory is left of this, of the 2020 crop that's going into the 2021 crop year, and that number will be higher than normal, just because we had so much to ship, not that much higher, but maybe 200 million pounds higher than we normally would have or what we predicted for this year. And then with its crop year next year that's forecast now to be 300 million pounds below the 2020 crop, you're sort of ending up with a wash there in terms of the numbers. And so I would take from this report that we have a steady supply going into next year. We've got a larger market demand than we've ever had. We have prices that have increased quite significantly just since Monday, since that report came out. And so I think it bodes well economically for the industry in 2021-2022, where hopefully we'll be able to readily market this quote-unquote steady supply at better returns for our growers.
Thank you again to Richard Wacott, President and CEO of the Almond Board of California. That's our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to hear about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I am Sabrina Halverson. From the JCS Marketing Team, thank you for listening.